This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, a challenging week here in D.C. Congress adjourned early and went home. Today, we're going to break with the news and share a recent lecture we hosted here at the Family Research Council. Kimberly Strassel, a member of the editorial board for the Wall Street Journal, discussed her most recent book, a national bestseller, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. We're going to hear from Kimberly in just a moment. Let me remind you, though, of the website, tonyperkins.com. You can find out more about not only today's program, but all of our programs archived there at tonyperkins.com. And if you're on Twitter, it's at T. Perkins. All right. Here is Kimberly Strassel, a member of the editorial board for the Wall Street Journal, here at the Family Research Council talking about her latest book, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech.
Good afternoon. It's a real honor to be asked to come and speak at the Family Research Council, which is an organization that just does so much good. And my appreciation to all of you for taking some time out of what are surely very busy days to come and listen for a few minutes. Since I am here at the Family Research Council, I figured I'd start and introduce this subject with a little story about my family, namely my three kids, who provide a wonderful illustration as a way of getting into this topic. I have three children. They are aged 12, 9, and 5. And they are your typical average everyday kids, which means that they exist. Their whole purpose on this earth is to annoy each other. And they are very, very good at it. They are excellent. And it was sometime last fall, and we were all sitting down for dinner. And the 12-year-old was doing a particularly good job of this with a 5-year-old. And she finally got so frustrated, she turned and looked at him and she said, "Oliver, you need to stop talking forever." And, of course, this inspired lots of people saying, "You can't do that. These are my free speech rights. You shut up. No, you shut up, Mom." And so I was trying to restore a little bit of order. And I said, "How about this? How about we all go around the table and you can each tell me what you think free speech is? What does it mean to you?" So the 12-year-old goes first. He's my very studious person, very orderly, thoughtful. And he gives this textbook definition of the First Amendment: the Bill of Rights, James Madison, Congress shall make no law. He even gets into, you know, there are certain exceptions for public safety and libel. And I was like, "Wow. Those private school fees are working out for me. That's good." The second child comes along. She's my middle child, so of course she feels perpetually ignored. She's also a rebel. She thinks no one ever listens to her enough. So she says, "I don't even know what public safety and libel exceptions are, but we shouldn't have them. You should be able to say whatever you want to whomever you want, whenever you want, in any circumstance. And by the way, you should all start by listening more to what I have to say." And then finally we get to the 5-year-old, and she's been paying a lot of attention to this discussion and thinking very hard about what she's going to say. And she looks at her brother and sister and at me, and she says, "Free speech is that you can say whatever you want as long as I like it." And, you know, I had one of those moments as a mom, and the parents in here will understand and appreciate, where everything falls into place in your kids. And I looked at the three of them and I realized my oldest child is a constitutional conservative. My middle child is a libertarian, and my youngest child is a socialist with totalitarian tendencies. But this is a really good way of getting into this conversation, because we have seen this profound shift in the country over the past, well, 8 years or a decade, that has seen a certain faction of the country, in particular the political left, adopting a new viewpoint, a 5-year-old's viewpoint on free speech, which is, you can say what you want as long as I'm good with it. Otherwise, you're not allowed to speak. And I think what's really interesting about this shift is that most shifts in Washington, and we're all here, those of us in this room, and we've witnessed this many times before, most political shifts, they take time. You can't even necessarily pinpoint when they happen. Suddenly, it's just there. But in this case, I would argue it does actually come down to a day. There was a day at which things changed, and that day was January 21st, 2010. And that was a day, some of you may remember, that the Supreme Court passed its Citizens United decision. Now, up to Citizens United, we had spent 100 years in this country creating more and more and more campaign finance regulations. I like to call them speech regulations. Some people call them campaign finance regulations. They'd been passed by both sides of the aisle for 100 years. And mostly, for the most part, while there are some groups out there who truly do believe campaign finance regulations lead to cleaner and better elections, better democracy, the people who actually pass the laws, those in Washington, they do it for another reason. They do it in order to largely silence their political opponents. And then we'd seen this happen over that century. We'd seen both sides of the aisle do it. Republicans imposed campaign finance regulations on labor unions to push them out of elections. Democrats passed campaign finance laws to push corporations out of elections. And they built up and built up until at a certain point the Supreme Court said, enough is enough. You've gone too far. You have stolen Americans' free speech rights. And we're going to repeal part of that giant campaign finance law known as McCain-Feingold, which they did on that day. And when you look out at the reaction to that decision, you saw two very different reactions. On the right had largely over the years come to get some religion on free speech and on the problems of campaign finance laws, and had increasingly stepped back from them and understood that they were not good for the cause of liberty. And so they cheered this decision. They were very, very happy. The left freaked out. For a couple of reasons. I think one is that over the years, they had increasingly found it hard to win arguments on policy discussions on the merits. And when you can't win an argument on the merit, it's much easier to simply tell your opponent not to talk. I think the other problem was you got to remember what the political environment was at this time. It's early 2010. The president, President Obama, has passed a number of laws that are already hugely unpopular in the country. You are already seeing a backlash grow up among the masses. You see Tea Party groups piling into the political sphere, and you see Democrats incredibly nervous that they're about to be swept out of the House, maybe out of the Senate, maybe in 2 years' time, lose the presidency. So they're very, very nervous. And in the days following Citizens United, they actually have a public discussion. What are we going to do? This is terrible. Put aside the question of whether or not we believe in campaign finance laws as a good. Like, this is just terrible for us politically. What are we going to do? And they come to a conclusion pretty quickly. And you can trace it, and I do in my book, The Intimidation Game, where they end up. And basically, they decide collectively, okay, if we can no longer use the law to outright bar our opponents from speaking in elections, we will do the next best thing. We will harass and intimidate them, scare them out of exercising the free speech rights that the United States Supreme Court restored to them. And that is, in essence, what we have seen happen over the last 6, 7, 8 years, is a very deliberate attempt by the left to say, if you continue to do this, you will pay a political and personal price. Now, so much of the discussion in the country has been about campus speech and speech codes and political correctness, all of which is very, very important. But one of the things I tried to do in the book is to show that, in fact, there are far scarier ways in which this intimidation is being exercised. And in essence, it's being exercised through the auspices of government and people who have power to do bad things to their political opponents. And we see it in a variety of different tactics in different realms. One of those tactics, a very popular one during the Obama age, was to sic the federal bureaucracy on your political opponents. And of course, the best example we have of that was the IRS targeting scandal. And think about the timing of that, right? It is early 2010, and the Democrats are very, very worried. And this is when the entire Tea Party targeting scandal begins. And if you go out and you talk to Senate Democrats, you talk to former Obama administration officials, they will to this day claim that this was just a couple of guys out in Cincinnati, line agents. They didn't know what they were doing. That is not true. We have very thorough investigations from the House and the Senate. They never did get a hold of all of the emails, but they got a hold of enough emails and documents to paint a very clear picture of what, in fact, happened here. And what happened was, following Citizens United, you had House and Senate Democrats begin to send letters to the IRS asking the IRS to go after the very organizations that the IRS ultimately went after. You had the President of the United States out on the stump every day with the largest megaphone in the land on behalf of candidates that were running for re-election, making the same speech every day. Look at these shadowy organizations that the court has unleashed into our political environment. We don't know who they are. We don't know if they're being funded illegally. They might be being operated by foreign entities. They're probably breaking campaign finance laws. Somebody needs to do something about it. It was a dog whistle to the IRS. You had outside leftist activist groups also sending in letters, also demanding action. And we now know from the emails and documents that you had Lois Lerner and a group of people around her who were very familiar with his policy discussion, very ideologically and politically on board with what they were being asked to do, and who did in fact act. And in the process, put some 400 different Tea Party organizations representing tens of thousands of Americans on ice for an entire midterm election. Not only an entire midterm election, an entire presidential election. We happen to know, and the investigation showed this, senior members of the Treasury Department figured out what was going on here in early 2012 and were very, very worried. They took some very minor steps to potentially address it. But in the meantime, they actually had discussions internally about how they could keep this from Congress if they were asked about it. And I think that the only logical conclusion that you can take from that is that there were senior officials who wanted this targeting to continue throughout the rest of the 2012 presidential election and to silence their political opponents. It is no accident in my mind that none of this came out until 2013. It went on for at least 3 years. People were well aware that it was happening. We had actually members of the IRS lying at times to Congress, including Lois Lerner herself, saying that it wasn't happening. So that's an example of a tactic that is very popular. We also saw similar things like this happen at the SEC, the FEC, the FCC, the whole alphabet soup of Washington. There were bureaucrats that were engaged in different actions that were meant to scare political opponents of that administration out of taking action in elections and speaking out. Another tactic we see, which I think is even more frightening, is prosecutorial abuse, because that, in fact, holds the potential of actually putting people in jail. And the scariest example of this I list in the book, and I always like to ask this question of audiences because it's always surprising and somewhat terrifying to me how few people have heard of this. But raise your hand if you've heard the Wisconsin John Doe probe. Oh my gosh, there's like two people in the room. That is so scary to me because this is one of the more egregious abuses of power the United States has witnessed in so long, in modern times. And what happened, in essence, is many of you will remember those public sector union reforms that Governor Scott Walker passed up in his state however many years ago. They were incredibly controversial. There were protests in the street. Some of the legislatures, Democrats, actually left the state for a while to keep them from passing it. They attempted to recall the governor, et cetera, and so on. So a very big moment for Wisconsin.
You've been listening to a special edition of Washington Watch. This is Kimberly Strassel, who recently spoke here at the Family Research Council about her newest book, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. In her discussion, she shines a much-needed light on the bullying and intimidation that the left engages in. We're going to hear more from Kimberly on the other side of this break, so don't go away. We'll be right back with more Washington Watch right after this.
Girls having privacy in school showers, locker rooms, and bathrooms is a no-brainer, right? Not everybody thinks so. Fairfax County, Virginia has become ground zero in the efforts to impose transgender ideology on American school children. The school system there is one of the largest in the United States, and its close proximity to Washington, D.C. has made it a target for the efforts to mainstream this radical ideology. Even after the Trump administration revoked Obama's directive threatening the nation's public schools, the fight continues at the state and district level. But parents and concerned citizens can fight back. In a recent panel discussion, three different perspectives from a school board member, a concerned parent, and an attorney are presented. They expose the tactics used by the transgender lobbyists and explore the strategies parents and taxpayers can use to fight back. Discover how to implement a 5-point plan to educate, explain, engage, empower, and elect in order to combat the transgender ideology in public schools. Visit frc.org/events to view this vital discussion.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms, in association with American Family Studios, introduces Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent.
I'm Ryan DeFrady's. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming, sweetie!
She's an agent! Get her, boys!
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Order yours today at ryansecretagent.com.
Dan Celia of Financial Issues.
Would you make one of the most important phone calls that you can make as far as your economic, your financial stewardship? I believe that permanent income is incredibly important to us, especially when you're retired. Listen, one thing we know for certain, the consumption of goods and your cost are never going to change. Make sure that you protect your income. Social Security, you will likely have maybe a pension. Add to permanent income with a charitable gift annuity and do the Lord's work. There's no better organization to do it with than the AFA Foundation, and no better time in our economy then right now.
Call and speak with a representative of the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along on this Friday afternoon. As I said, we're kind of taking a break from the news cycle and listening to a message that was given here at the Family Research Council by Kimberly Strassel. She is a member of the editorial board for the Wall Street Journal, and she was discussing her most recent book, a national bestseller, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. We'll pick up where we left off. Here's Kimberly.
There were about 30 different conservative groups that supported those government reforms out in the public during the period at which there were attempts to recall the governor. In the wake of that, several Democratic prosecutors in the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office decided to launch a bogus campaign finance probe into those 30 different groups. They did it under something called the John Doe Law in Wisconsin, which thankfully for America is not something you find in most states, but it did exist in Wisconsin. And what it allowed the prosecutors to do was to conduct their investigation entirely in secret and to impose a gag order on all of those who were the subjects of the investigation. So if you were being investigated, you could not tell anybody that you were the subject of an investigation, not even your wives. You could go to jail for years and pay tens of thousands of fines if you violated that gag order. The people who were subject to this gag order and this investigation had their voicemails listened to, their emails confiscated, their financial records riffled through. Some of them had their houses raided in the pre-dawn morning light. One of the scariest stories out of this is that one of the targets of this investigation was off on a charitable fundraising trip with his wife. His teenage son was home alone. The police showed up in the early morning dark, busted into the house, put him in a room, would not allow him to call an attorney, would not allow him to call his grandparents who lived down the road, ransacked the house, took away a bunch of computer technology, and as they left, said, if you tell anyone what happened to you this morning, you could go to jail. So these are the kind of tactics that were being used up in Wisconsin. I'd just like to add as an aside here, too, that if you ever follow campaign finance investigations, about 97% of them are done on a civil basis. It is extremely unusual to do a criminal investigation for a campaign's finance violation. It's reserved for some of the most egregious violations. So that in itself said something about the aims of the prosecutors here. The only reason we even know about this is because one of the men who was a target of this investigation very bravely came to the Wall Street Journal editorial page and told us what was happening. We wrote some editorials about it. It became national news. A lawsuit was ultimately filed. It went all the way up to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. It took the Wisconsin State Supreme Court to shut down this probe. And I just want to paraphrase for you one of the lines that came out of that ruling, because it says everything you need to know about the prosecutor's motives in this case. The Supreme Court said, and again, I'm slightly paraphrasing, the prosecutors in this case invented theories of law in order to go after citizens who were wholly innocent of wrongdoing. So this was the highest court in that state essentially saying that the prosecutors were engaged in outright intimidation and threatening actions for the sole reason of shutting down their political opponents. And we have seen those kind of tactics, the prosecutorial abuse tactic, happen be replicated in other states as well, too, Montana, a few other places. We also see it in a wider level. More recently, in the months since my book came out, we've had 17 attorneys general across the country announced that they are considering bringing racketeering charges against Exxon and some 100 different conservative groups that have worked with Exxon over the years for the so-called crime of thinking the wrong way on climate change. So these are the sort of examples of prosecutorial abuse. Again, you can't win the argument on climate on the merits, then you let Exxon and all of the groups that work with it, that if they continue to oppose you in the political and the policy realm, they could have a RICO lawsuit filed against them. We see it in terms of protests and boycotts and blackmail actions that are taken against corporations that continue to exercise their free speech rights. There is an entire array of activists groups out there. They actually have conferences where they meet and they talk about who their next corporate target will be. They try to find the most awful thing that they can that a corporation has donated to. They then go from board member to board member and threaten to run campaigns and ads in their states, calling them racists or homophobes or whatever it is, in order to get them to stop taking part in elections. You see it in terms of proxy battles that are going on in companies. There's an array of social investing companies that are allied with these liberal activist groups that go into board meetings. They buy shares in a company solely so that they can file a proxy ballot in the company, and that proxy ballot tries to convince all the shareholders that it is not in the company's interest to continue expressing their free speech views about free markets or better economic regulations, whatever it may be. We see these tactics being used against average individuals. And I think that this is a really important thing, because many people out there think, well, this is just how politics is played. It's bare knuckle. If you're going to be in this realm, you have to expect something like this. No, this just happens against average, ordinary Americans. Many of you will remember the battle in California over Proposition 8, which was a ballot initiative in favor of traditional marriage. The people who gave money in favor of Prop 8, of course, their names and their addresses were disclosed in campaign finance records. Activists out in the state took those names, took those addresses, and put them on a searchable, walkable map so that opponents could go home to home and harass anybody who had given money to Prop 8. The people who were on that searchable, walkable map had their cars keyed, their windows broken, their kids harassed. They had threatening messages left on their voicemails, sent over emails. Some of them who were small business owners had flash mob protesters show up outside of their business, refuse to let customers come in. Some of them lost their jobs. Most famously, Brendan Eich at Mozilla. Many of you may have heard his name, but there were many other people who lost their jobs besides that didn't get near the attention that he did. The book has an example of individuals who've been made the targets of entire federal bureaucracies. Back in 2012, a relatively wealthy business owner named Frank Vandersloot in Idaho gave a sizable donation to a super PAC that was supporting Mitt Romney. Not long after that, after campaign finance records came out showing this donation, Mr. Vandersloot, along with a number of other donors, ended up on the president's campaign reelection site, accompanied by a number of words suggesting that he was unethical, a crook, all kinds of bad things.
You're listening to a special edition of Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Friday afternoon. Now, don't go away because we're going to hear more from Kimberly Strassel right after this break as she continues talking about her bestseller, The Intimidation Game, how the left is silencing free speech. Don't go away. We're right back after this.
Making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
You know, so many of us put money in our money market account. That's a good place to put it, right? It's safe. We don't have to worry about it being exposed to the markets. It should be FDIC insured because certainly if it's in a bank, it would be FDIC insured. So if there was ever a collapse of that particular bank, you would at least be able to take some peace knowing that it's insured and you're going to be covered and you're not going to lose money. Here's a couple of things about money market accounts that you need to know. One is you need to understand if you have a mutual fund money market account, it's not FDIC insured. That's important to note. As a matter of fact, in 2008, when we had the beginning of the financial crisis, there were many money market account mutual funds that dipped below the value that they had before the crisis, meaning that a dollar that was in there was no longer worth a dollar. That put, of course, fear in the financial markets. As a matter of fact, it prompted an immediate law to increase FDIC insurance to $250,000. Dollars because people were flocking out of money market accounts and moving into the banks. They're not always FDIC insured. If that is important to you, you need to ask the question, is this account FDIC insured? If it isn't, then you may want to consider moving it to a bank if that is important to you, the safety of FDIC insurance.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Welcome back to this special edition of Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. We've been listening to Kimberly Strassel on her book, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. Let me encourage you, check out the website, TonyPerkins.com. Lots of resources there for you. In addition to, we still are collecting signatures for the petition regarding Senator Bernie Sanders and his imposition of a religious test on one of President Trump's nominees. You can find out more about that at the website, TonyPerkins.com. And again, if you're on Twitter, you can keep up with me, at T. Perkins. All right, here's Kimberly, as she was speaking here recently at the Family Research Council.
Not long after that, Mr. Vandersloot got his first visit from the IRS in his life. Then he got a second one. And then he got a visit from the Department of Agriculture and various other agencies of the federal government, too. He came out, he actually went on TV and said, the President of the United States painted a target on my back. And that was the federal bureaucracy. I think we have to, in all fairness, believe looking at the guy in charge, taking his dog whistle again and going after someone that the highest, most important and most powerful person on the planet had suggested was a crook. And it's why when you're president, you don't do things like that. One of the things that we see run through all of these tactics, and it's something everyone needs to have a new awareness of and be concerned about, is disclosure. Okay? When we hear the words disclosure or transparency, they sound good to us, and they should be. But the problem we have in this country is that our system of disclosure has now been turned on its head. Disclosure is meant to be a way by which citizens keep track of their government. But if you, for instance, watched the Hillary Clinton server escapade of last year, you will know that, in fact, government officials have become very, very good at hiding from the people anything they don't want the people to see. Instead, disclosure has become a weapon, a means by which government and activists keep track of their political opponents. And they actually use it in order to come up with new lists of people to go after, new lists of people to target, and then to exercise these tactics that I just mentioned on. You know, for instance, we've seen, and they're very devoted to this, now Senator, former California Attorney General Kamala Harris, and New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, two of the more liberal AGs in the country, have been on a campaign for the last 2 years to force every nonprofit to disclose their donors in their states. You know, and I can tell you that is not for good government reasons. They want to hand those names over to their activist friends so that they can go into the boardrooms, they can go into the personal houses and do to these entities that speak out what the IRS did to the Tea Party, what the activists did to the Prop 8 donors, what they're doing every day to corporations, so they can scare them out of taking part again. And we need to be very, very concerned about that because it has become one of their main ways that they go about this intimidation. And if you look right now out there in practically every state in the country, there is some sort of disclosure initiative, always filed and pushed by the liberals. They will put it in the best possible terms. This is all about cleaner governments and cleaner elections. That's not what it's about. So what do we do about all this? Like, I feel like everyone looks so down in the audience. I'm sorry. It does. It's like a parade of horribles. I had several people tell me that this book read like a thriller, a real life thriller. And it's true. The things that are in it, you honestly can't believe that they actually happened to real people. I interviewed about 60 or 70 people to whom these tactics had been exercised upon. They were the subjects of these attacks and try to just tell their stories in real time as they were happening. And it's a very frightening read by the end. I always feel bad. People, they say, I bought your book, and I want to say, I hope you enjoy it. But you know what? It's just not enjoyable. It might be interesting. It could be fascinating, but it's not enjoyable. So what do we do about this? There are things that we can do about this. The first most important thing, that's why I wrote the book, is we have to know that it's happening. And that was the thing that finally inspired me to write a book, because believe me, I have so many other things to do. Just looking after that five-year-old is hard enough. But it was when I realized that none of these things were coincidental or random, that they were part of a strategy. Because if you look out there in the broad realm, it's always the same senators who are sending the letters. It's always the same activist groups who are working together to attack people. It's always the same bureaucrats that end up coming out, their headlines and their names are in thing. You know, a funny little thing that that just shows some of the connections, okay? Lois Lerner, not many people know this, but Lois Lerner, out in the IRS, turns out she was a really good buddy with one of the guys in Wisconsin who was deeply involved in the John Doe probe. You know, so they're going after nonprofits in Wisconsin. She's going after nonprofits down here. They're all having conversations with Public Citizen and different outside liberal activist groups. This is a strategy, people. It is a new part of politics, and it's being exercised every day. So we need to know that it's happening. You know, this is just not like one bad actor here or there. It is a plan. When we see it, we need to call it out. And that was actually one of the inspiring things about the book, is having spoken to all these people, I expected to kind of go meet these tyrannized, broken down Americans who'd been subject to attacks by their government and outside forces. In fact, most of them won their battles, and they did so by coming out and exposing what had happened.
You've been listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. We've been listening to Kimberly Strassel, who spoke recently here at the Family Research Council regarding her new book, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. I wanted you to be able to hear the remarks that Kimberly made. I have a very insightful, it's a great book that she was lecturing on here at the Family Research Council. But I wanted you to be able to hear in depth what she had to say about the tactics of the left. Now, don't go away. There's a little bit more of Kimberly to come on the other side of this break. So don't go away. We're right back after this.
A boat ride on the Sea of Galilee. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman with American Family Association and American Family Radio. That is a highlight of our tour of the Holy Land when we go on the boat ride on the Sea of Galilee. A special time to be on the very water where Jesus walked, where he spent time with his disciples. And you know, in fact, you're the place where Jesus was. So many sights we're going to see in the Holy Land that are just like that. We know Jesus was here. The trip is in March, March 8th through the 16th, and we'd love for you to come with us. So many places we're going to see, you've read about since you were a child. For more information, go to the website twholyland.com. That's twholyland.com. If you want a brochure sent to you in the mail, just call us at 800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, extension 5.
Physicians keep learning after medical school in order to better save lives. Shouldn't Christian leaders keep learning to better save souls? Hi, I'm Dr. John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi, and online around the world. Are you a Christian leader who thinks it's important to keep learning? WBS online weekend and evening classes allow graduate students to become better equipped to make disciples in a constantly changing world. For more information, visit wbs.edu.
1MillionDads.com is where men can learn and grow together as men of the cross. Close families and even national revival begin at home with strong fathers in the faith.
I really like how the website provides so many articles. They're all just dead on to help me as a father.
Go to the website, read the articles. You're not alone. 1MillionDads.com. Lead or others will.
So, what would you do with an extra $500 a month in your budget? $500. This isn't hypothetical, by the way. This is something you may need to think about very soon if you decide to become a member of MediShare. MediShare is a way to pay for your health care, and typically it costs $500 less per month for a family versus other health care plans. So seriously, think about this. You could pay off loans, pay down a mortgage, save the money for retirement, donate to charity. That would be a big deal. But you know what? Here's the best thing. MediShare works. It has 250,000 members, and it's growing fast. With MediShare, not only do you save, you don't have to pay for things you don't believe in either, and that is a beautiful thing too. So here's how you can find out more, and you might actually wind up saving even more than $500 a month. So check into it. Here's the number. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23, now available in Montana. 855-PSALM-23.
Welcome back to this special edition of Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along this Friday afternoon. As I mentioned at the top of the program, kind of breaking with the news cycle from this week. It's been an intense week. And so I thought we'd go back to a recent discussion here at the Family Research Council, a lecture by Kimberly Strassel, a member of the editorial board for the Wall Street Journal. And she was here discussing her most recent book, which is a national bestseller, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. Timely, important information. And so that's why I wanted to share it with you. So here's Kimberly as she was wrapping up her remarks here at the Family Research Council.
In fact, most of them won their battles, and they did so by coming out and exposing what had happened and talking about it. Because here's one piece of good news. The subtitle of my book is How the Left is Silencing Free Speech. And I use that term very specifically because it's the organized political left that is doing this. And one of the findings from the book is that, in fact, most of the rest of America, whether it's the right or the right of center or the left of center, or if it's just a general Democrat, a general Republican, people who are not that organized political left, they do not agree with these tactics. They believe in the First Amendment. They do not like to see things like this happen. And when people get called out, the bullies don't like to be exposed. And often they then do back down, and there's a lot of support for making the tactics stop. So you got to call it out and not be scared, because again, what's the point? What's the idea behind intimidation? It's to make people go silent. So many people that I interviewed as part of the IRS thing in particular, these wonderful average Americans who'd started up these Tea Party organizations, they were terrified when the IRS started sending them letters and or people started knocking on their doors. And their first instinct was to say, I don't want to put my head up any higher, because I don't have the resources or the ability to handle this kind of onslaught. It was only when some people actually did that it ended up getting exposed and stopped. I think we need to rethink at a huge level in both the federal government and the state level the powers of the administrative state. Because it is a sad reality that we live in an administrative state these days. So many decisions that affect our lives, and so many decisions that unfortunately affect our political engagement, are done by nameless, faceless bureaucrats that have that are not accountable to anyone, a la the IRS. Okay, and we simply should not have a situation in which there are bureaucrats making decisions over the political rights of average Americans. So, of course, the obvious way of dealing with this would just be to halve the size of the federal government. But in the absence of that actually happening, we need to, department by department, go through, take a look at what a lot of these bureaucrats are doing, and remove from them the power to do some of this. The IRS should not in any way be making a decision about whether or not a nonprofit is or is not operating within its political rights, okay? It should be making sure it filled out its forms the right way. And then we should change the system and the law so that if somebody has a complaint and suggests that that nonprofit exceeded its nonprofit status or engaged in politics that it should not, you file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission, which is at least a bipartisan agency with three Republicans and three Democrats. You need four members to vote to take action on anything. Those different members of the FEC are appointed by the president. They're confirmed by the Senate. They have public accountability, and they have to make the decisions in public. That's how those kind of decisions about the political rights of Americans should be held. And there are a lot of other examples of a federal bureaucracy that also have the ability to interfere in Americans' political rights. We need to strip that from them. Another important thing, too, we need to rethink our entire system of disclosure laws in this country. You know, even the best campaign finance, free speech people that I know wouldn't go so far as to say that you should stop recording and making public direct donations from people to politicians. But maybe we need to rethink the thresholds at which those are reported. You know, right now, if you make a donation of more than $200 to a federal official, your name and address goes into a public file. Well, I don't mean to sound cynical, but I've been in Washington a long time, and I can tell you there ain't no politician in this city that's getting bought off for $200. That won't even buy you a cup of coffee. So maybe that number needs to be 5,000. Maybe it needs to be 10,000. Maybe we need to offer a better safe harbor for the average citizen who wants to be engaged in politics but is very scared about the ramifications of it. Because, by the way, disclosure, you don't even know how disclosure is being used against you. And that's the really scary thing. You know, let's say you go to do a job interview. And you go in and you think you have a great first interview and you never get a call back. Is that because the guy who interviewed you went to see who you donated to in the last election? Let's say you have a kid who's an excellent athlete, but he doesn't make the varsity team. Is that because the coach went and took a look at what your politics are and disagreed with it and decided not to give them? There's many, many reasons why average Americans don't want their information shared with their friends or their neighbors or their communities or their employers or other people that have some sort of power or influence over them. So I think we need to rethink thresholds. We need to rethink whether or not there is value in requiring disclosure for groups that run issue ads, simply ads that educate the public and don't, in fact, advocate for a specific politician or against a specific politician. I think we need ask whether or not we need disclosure for ballot initiative donations, like what happened out in Prop 8. Is there a real risk of corruption in ballot initiatives, or maybe only in certain kinds of them? Otherwise, can we perhaps give people some anonymity in politics so that they feel safer? So again, those are some of the things that we can do. I think, as I mentioned before, the really positive thing is that there is still an overriding love and belief for the First Amendment in this country. And there's an overriding surge, just in recent times, to be involved. I mean, that's been the interesting thing, and I think that's one of the reasons we see this intimidation game ramping up, because we've seen so much enthusiasm from new corners of the country to be engaged in politics. And that scares some people. They don't want more voices. They want fewer. One other thing I think we need to look at, and I'm just going to throw in there too, is I think those on the conservative side also need to be very, very wary that we do not fall into the trap, once in power, of then exercising any of these intimidation tactics on our opponents. I have heard too many people, it's alarming to me, say, yeah, let's have the IRS go take down the Clinton Foundation. You know, I mean, this is just what happened to so many people out there. There may well be violations, but the fact that people are suggesting of using the IRS as a tool in that fashion for pure political retribution is concerning. I think we also need to keep track of our new president, who is doing many great things. But as I mentioned that story about former President Obama and individuals, you know, this is a president who likes to tell companies what will happen to them if they don't do what he says. It's important to know that the power of the presidency is immense, and we have to be very careful that we don't paint targets on other people's backs as well, too.
That was terrific, Kim.
Thank you.
I really appreciated it. I don't need another book to read, but
I'm sorry to say
I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to.
And, thank you.
Who on the Hill is picking up this message and doing something about it, holding hearings or exposing this?
So one of the people that I spent a lot of time with and is one of the main characters in the book is Ohio Representative Jim Jordan, who has been amazing on the IRS stuff in particular. And he, of course, spearheaded the investigation into what actually happened there and really did find a lot of the answers. But what I love about Representative Jordan is that he got it. Like, he understood that this was, again, not some bureaucratic snafu. It wasn't accidental, that there was thought behind this. It was part of a broader strategy. And he goes to a lot of effort to let all of his colleagues know about this game and what's going on. There's been a lot of effort by Peter Roskam to do some of the reforms that would, in fact, rein in the IRS and the bureaucracy. A lot of people in the Freedom Caucus are aware of this question because they understand that, you know, as Representative Jordan said to me when I was interviewing him for this, he goes, it's not just that this happened. It happened with regard to the First Amendment, but then even, which is one of the most important rights we have, but more importantly, it was an attack on political speech, which within the First Amendment is the most important form of speech that we have. So trying to take that away is just something that everyone needs to be incredibly scared of. People forget, by the way, and I could never understand why there wasn't more outrage about this. Maybe it was because of the way the candidates phrased it and the press just let it go. But both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders had as one of their top three campaign promises a vow to alter the First Amendment. Okay, I mean, they didn't put it that way. They said, we're going to put a new amendment forward that will repeal Citizens United. Well, Citizens United was upheld by the First Amendment. The only way you can repeal Citizens United is to change the First Amendment. And in essence, what they were suggesting, and you could look, they had some model language on what they would do. They were suggesting a First Amendment in which the government gets to decide who speaks in elections. So much for Congress shall make no law. Anyway.
Other questions? I have one that I'd love to ask. So you talked about the first step being awareness as to what's happening here. So what do you owe the general secrecy and the ignorance of the majority of the population over situations like the John Doe probe out in Wisconsin?
I
knew of it because I'm a Wisconsin native, and so it came through the back channels for me, but it's not something I think many of us ordinarily would have heard if we didn't have a connection to it in another way. So how do we become more aware of situations where there is governmental abuse of power?
Yeah. I blame this, by the way, on the media. They are so, I mean, many in the mainstream media are so wedded to these nonsense ideas about dark money and corruption. By the way, a little statistic for everybody here, which I just think is so important. We as a nation spend about $7 billion every election cycle, every two-year election cycle, electing a federal government, okay? If that sounds like a lot of money to you, just to let you know, that's approximately the amount of money that we spend every year on Halloween. Okay, so I would like to think forming the greatest democracy on the planet every 2 years is at least worth as much as what we spend on milk duds and Supergirl costumes. But if you talk to the left, you know, this is just way too much money in politics. It's horrific. We shouldn't have all of this. And by the way, of that $7 billion, about 3% is what they call dark money. I call it protected money. It is the money that is given to 501c4s, 501c3s, often by very small donors who don't want to have happen to them the things that I just described. And that's why we have those protections in place. The media, the left, they have owned this conversation, unfortunately. The whole dark money narrative and the secrecy and the too big of money in politics and corporations running the country, it's just not true. Because the other thing I just like to point out about money and speech too is you can have all the money in the world and if you have a bad idea, it will not help you. And if you want a case study in that, go look at the money that Tom Steyer spent in the last midterm election. He spent something like $80 million and lost pretty much every Senate candidate he backed because they were bad and people were mad. So you can spend all the money you want. It's not going to help you if you don't have a good idea.
Let's give, Mr. Russell, we do have one more. You are a lucky winner today.
Sorry for double dipping, but I was going to ask you before about senators, and now that the Senate has come up, but not in a favorable way. Right. Are any of the senators getting into this to really help this
mostly
cause?
Mostly we've only seen kind of bad. There's a group of about 12 very liberal Democrats who are behind a lot of the letters. You know, they've tried to tee up not just Alec, but the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Sent a letter to all the members of the board of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce saying the chamber didn't support the president's climate regulatory agenda. That makes it a climate denier. Are you comfortable sitting on the board of a trade organization that's a climate denier? So you see a lot of the same senators. And by the way, they were the same senators that sent the letter to the IRS asking them to go after the Tea Party organizations. And they're the same senators pressuring the SEC to force corporations to disclose any of their political giving. It's always the same group. On the other side, Senator Mike Lee is really good on this. Ted Cruz is very good on this. That was something that was very notable, I thought, when Senator Cruz ran for the presidency, is he talked about this a lot on the stump, saying, you know, I will be a constitutional president. I will protect constitutional rights. And that was a kind of direct reference to a lot of the things that he had seen happening and he knew were going on. Because this outrages a lot of people, even in the Tea Party world, for instance, who weren't the direct subject to these attacks. They were outraged by this and lived it daily, the misery of having the IRS breathing down your neck, asking you, sending you 90 questionnaires. Thank you. Thank you all.
You've been listening to Kimberly Strassel, who spoke recently here at the Family Research Council. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along this Friday afternoon. But guess what? We're out of time. So I want to thank you for joining us, but I want to encourage you, visit the website, tonyperkins.com. You can find out more about Kimberly and her book. But also, let me leave you with this. The Apostle Paul in Ephesians 6, he tells us when we've done everything we can do, when we've prayed, when we've prepared, when we've taken our stand, regardless of the intimidation, regardless of the tactics that others may use, you and I must just keep standing. Have a great weekend.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.